Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you, Joan. I have to quote Jimmy. I have ADD. I might be talking to you, but I might be thinking about naked people. I think that's just, I love that. You should have that on a shirt. I love that. And I wanted to say hi to a couple people. Bobby Paycheck has a brand new chapbook, which you should buy. It's called The Trolley Man, or British, The Trolleyman. I don't know how you say it. It's really good, and it's it looks like a City Lights book in design. There it is right there. And I want to say hi to Lisa Alexander and Celeste Ganey and Kayla, and it's exciting to see everybody. I'm going to read some new poems and some poems from the Water books as well. So just start right in here. In cities bigger than Pittsburgh, like L.A., New York, informal hiring sites are called shape-ups, and usually women are standing at these places looking for work. In Mammoth, September. Steps above the expressway, she, no one hires first. They want the young student with good command of English to clean the loft or snip strings from jackets. The woman on the overpass suffers changing weather, folds, unfolds her legs on, off a bus every day to stand on hot asphalt, to be or not selected by strangers who walk up and offer day pay. Noon, she vanishes after swift negotiations, 20 cents below minimum. Space she took on the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway is a sliver pattern in my mind, can't get out pattern. Mothers fight for their kids 20 cents below minimum. I'm here to give a poetry reading. I told her this, woman I met while waiting for a bus in Mammoth, September's 88-degree morning. We were trying to talk to each other, Polish, English, reverse, start over. One time she ended up in the wrong building, elevator with a stuck emergency button and a day boss twice her size. I asked, but knew better. Some poems about the weather. This one's called Skyline and Sky. Thanks to the cattail rain, the terracotta pots are saturating and their salt essences will patina, offering new maps to think about. The ant colonies must be in their sand hills, the jays in their white pine, waiting out this easy straight down shower that pounds the straw under the Italian parsley and flashes the canoe-shaped sage leaves, green, then silver. Rain is soaking the catty nines fleshier, and the height they project sharpens my comprehension of skyline and sky. In front of me, the delicate ladder of the clematis and the sideways scribbles of Jasper Johns, whose book I'm reading on my porch. He called it scribbling, but could do it in his sleep. He could make a line twist and release a wash, thick or thin, not only at the edges, but inside the wild lakes of his blues, marking depths and miniature Gulf Streams. I imagine him thinking, then sketching time itself as it occurs in the making of a cattail reed. The tall entity it becomes, damp and thinly fibrous at first, then darker as its fur velvet accumulates up from stem to tip. Every mark of his pen darkens the empty space, but holes remain, rifts, so that during this summer rain, an entire population of gnats might take shelter in a single cattail. Free space, pinprick of habitat, their nonstop breathing factory of eyes, lenses, rods, and cones in their haven and 12-hour lives. I'm going to read a translation I did, another kind of seasonal poem. This is Giovanni Pascoli's poem, Night Jasmine. Night flowers open the hours I think of those I love. The dusk butterflies arrived at the viburnum. The crying stopped and a while ago. Across the street, a house settles. Nests relax under wings like eyes under lids. The scent of ripe strawberries lifts from open goblets. A lamp shines in my front room. Grass springs from ditches. A late bee hums. The cells are already taken. A hen struts through the bluing yard, followed by her starry chirping. All night long, scent passes with the wind. Light drifts up the stairs, glows out from the first floor, is shut off. Now it's dawn, and jasmine petals close, slightly crumpled. In those soft, secret urns, new happiness. I can't say what. I'll read this one for Eva Sims. I don't know. After the winter and spring we had, I'm still pulling out weeds that are taller than I am. Everywhere I look, I'm cleaning something. So that's what this is about, cleaning the alley. Up early and feeling long-stemmed and moist, bright and eloquent even, a woodland pool. I go down anyway, tie the bandana, down the six steps to the margin of my 16th acre pig-eared to the alley, whose blonde bricks remain the pride of Regent Square's Belle Epoque, when every house stocked caves of coal and ice. Elephant ears, I bow to you and attack the mile-a-minute vine the city is burning out of the parks. Hear the clutch of sumac I'll need the cudgel for. The worst I kneel to with gloves and my old plastic windshield scraper. The slimed untouchables, condom, Twinkie, dog shit, bird part. And a fresh skull can dropped accidentally, maybe, by the garbage men I've been embarrassed to be seen by. Putting this off all spring. Haywire cracks form Pennsylvania twisted sideways and strangely inspire me, though the weeds are tight as burlap and require the knife. I'm sweating, breathing bar grease and diesel and sucking lungfuls of heavy metal, get more bags, a bucket of water. I pull weeds knowing labor I was intended for. Paul, our family's youngest 73-year-old, laughed the month he died. Your problem is you're still waiting for the revolution. You missed it, kid. It was Roosevelt. I'm into this. I tend my place the way he shoveled township paperwork, though he should have been governor. All involves mind, calloused to a blunt force tool. I hear the megabus voice box murmur, downtown and waterfront, and feel the itchy new money drilling our Marcellus. No future till it's made, but 50 years without pruning in New York City would be parkland. My state could reclaim its sylvan kingdom. This could be wetland drinking from the city culverts and ditches. Now the goldenrod monsters give way and fill another bag. It's time to pour vinegar water over my 10-by-8 brick wedge. Welcome to my house, back entrance, the dead head of geraniums pungent and refreshed. Camping on the Hudson. Don't come up, you'll get lost, a voice said. Spring is rinsing the old rail towns and floating barges clean as wet onyx. I'm daydreaming up here, you can't be seen, the white pines are so tall. Lenape estuary, older than the Etruscans and their fishing boat prayers. Older than the western arm of the Susquehanna, now buried under the shale fields. I walk the banks as if they were mine, magnified versions of the small rivers of home. Don't thank God, thank Pete Seeger, the voice said. The metal green waters wide and sea-like. Ducks cruise a quiet inlet a mile square. They used to be scared of sailing up here alone at night. The cats wailed and wailed. Last night, my fire made my eyes smart. The wood was too wet. I was shaking when I found the paw print and scruff of fur in the bushes. The screeches even rattled Henry Hudson, marten, lynx, polecat. At home, we call them all bobcat. Not minding the difference. Ships came up through the narrows and busted their hulls on the jagged edges. The yowling never stopped all night. They camped close to the water, thinking the big cats wouldn't come down to drink. The best views are far from everything, but poor people never get to see them. Before I went to sleep, I doused my fire and looked into the dark. Far away, the northern lights, siphons, and scarlet wheels sculpt themselves, throw off shapes into the eyes of their beholder, whose face they mimic and imitate, and shift again to cat eyes, and now my fire rings, topaz, and saffron stars. The cool thing about reading with Jan and Ed is we've all worked together in one way or another for so many years now. And I have to say about Ed Ochester, we had an argument once over this poem, about 20-minute argument about the difference between bobcats, polecats, lynx, marten. And, you know, it's the kind of thing we argue about. So you got to call it a bobcat. Yeah. So.
That's true.
Okay, I'm going to read this poem. It's new. It's for Peter Oresic, and a lot of you know the wonderful poet he is, and the fact of his, no public bad disclosure here, the fact of his brain surgery this spring. I'm happy to say he's doing really well, and so this is for him. It's called Overlook by Night. And it's situated up on the West End Overlook, which is my favorite view of Pittsburgh. High above street din, a platform banked by a skinny fir and someone's plywood cupboard, brown bean cans and jug of water stored. West End's rock ramp telescopes the new highway's construction signs flapping like just minted Buddhist flags, but no calm. The all-night men rake hot asphalt. Tiny metal tools, metallic eyelashes scraping the roadway. The line snakes its dark satin, no berms or guardrails yet. Only a line in darkness unrolls against open earth slabs, rutted with storms and backlit cement block tracts. Locked warehouses of sheetrock and giant bracelet link ironworks sleep until a casual gesture of a Harrisburg oligarch stretches one reluctant finger in our direction. Thousand Legger and I grip the rail of our poor Belvedere, watching the cherry picker driver lift another steel pipe and swing it precisely toward his buddy, who unfastens it front end, lays it down, laboring through drizzle, lit with a thousand circles of street lights, hugging the seven hills, while I pull my jacket closer and float a line toward a wingback chair where Peter's probably finishing Hreeball and calibrating a new definition of what an hour can mean. Up here, I'm letting objecthood work its distractions and try again to place myself in real time, use its copper vibe to aim a hello to the perimeter's artifact Sunoco, old washroom tacked onto its side. How Keith, fourth-generation owner, swabs it down summer mornings and arranges his wife's zinnias in a jelly jar so travelers find the restroom not only sparkling, but anchored with purples, reds, and sunbath yellows in the jar placed just so on the shelf above the sink, light bouncing off it up high, through the glass block also shining above the unrolling new road like a 24-hour headlamp. All around the perimeter, kitchen or bed lights embrace the unsleeping. Last poem. A lot of you, I mean, it's nice to read here because this is home, and a lot of you know I was raised in a family of old Polish women whose major social activity really was going to funerals. And when they came back from these funerals, they looked so haunted to me, and I thought they were melodramatic, and I didn't understand what they were saying. So this poem is in part about that. When the old women whispered of the death throes. When the old women whispered of the death throes, their terror carved ditches down their cheeks and painted their faces, rain or shine, with dirt from the graves one or another tried leaping into. The hysterical violins not pausing till all had gone, whispering how he suffered and twisted, how she tried to crawl out of bed up a wall to her mother. Terror tinted their faces, forehead to neckline, till a new death glazed them again, another layer of permanent wash. How much rain under this rain? So clear, I saw through it to the loving gaze of my mother come back to me last night, reminding me I was wrong. She'd bored her hour in automatic transport to gates, tunnel, or bridge. No, when she turned onto her left side to clasp the metal bars, such a terror came over her, even while she stretched one hand up to grasp the strong wrist of Satinhead, her name, still naming, still talking her art for her new friend, the 6'6" handsome bald aide who didn't have to stay in the ER. He was done for the night. But he stayed while she reached up through the spasms, her eyes staring so hard, I thought she was trying to see in reverse inside her own body, while she cried to us. She was so afraid, and there was nothing we could do to pull her out. Thank you so much.